All right, go ahead and have a seat. Good morning. This morning we are here for our first case, which is Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce versus Tony Evers, 20 AP 2081 and 2103. Could you state your appearances, please? Okay. Good morning. And we also have East Troy High School here with us this morning, I believe. If you could rise and we could properly welcome you. Good group. Good morning. Nice to have you here. I think you'll be stuck with me talking to you a little later if you have time to stick around. If not, that's fine too. But I'll come out and see if you have any questions. We won't talk about the case. But yeah, we can have a little chat together if time permits. All right, then, go ahead and have a seat, and we will start up with oral arguments. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley passed me a note, and I didn't mean to exclude you by any means. Please state your appearance as well. Okay, excellent. Good to see you as well. All right, then, 25 minutes. Followed by 20 minutes, followed by 10 minutes, followed by 5 minutes, correct? Good. All right, let's start up with Mr. Rose now.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Scott Rose now on behalf of the three business associations. This case is about access to the courts. The two questions presented ask whether the but the pleading statement. This court should answer the two questions presented as follows. It should first hold that the associations had standing to pursue this lawsuit, and second, it should hold that the notice statute 19.356 does not prohibit this lawsuit. I'd like to begin by talking about the notice statute, which is the second question presented, because I think it's the more significant.
Someone is going to ask you to speak up, so it might as well be me.
Okay, I can try to talk a little more loudly.
Or maybe
the
mic just
needs to be
maybe
for him a little bit. He's a little bit taller.
I can raise the podium otherwise.
Yeah. I think that'll be better for you.
Is this a little bit better?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. So if I may, I'd like to begin with the second question presented. And this question involves two Wisconsin statutes. There is the notice statute, 19.56, and then there's the Uniform Declaratory Judgments Act, or DJA. And the second question involves the interplay between these two statutes. And the parties, the petitioners and respondents, seem to agree on a couple of basic points involving the second question. They seem to agree that there was a common law right to pre-release notice and judicial review since at least 1996. And they also agree that the 2003 enactment of the notice statute changed those common law rights in some way. The dispute between the parties centers on the extent to which the notice statute abrogated the common law. And my client's position is that the notice statute was only a partial abrogation of the common law, not a total, complete abrogation. And there are a couple of significant canons of statutory construction that courts apply when they look at whether a statute abrogated the common law. And these two canons are very closely related. And they come from a case, NBZ, Inc. versus Pilarski, which I cited in my reply brief. So the first canon holds that a court must strictly construe a statute so as to have minimal effect on the common law. And the other related canon holds that a statute abrogates a common law rule only if the intent to abrogate is so clearly expressed as to leave no question or no doubt as to what the legislature intended. So with those two canons of construction in mind, I think it's important to properly frame the second question presented. So the second question is really about whether the notice statute clearly, unequivocally, and completely abrogated the common law right to judicial review to block the release of a record. And that's really where the state and the Journal Sentinel get a little bit off track, because the gist of their argument, at the risk of oversimplification, is that this type of lawsuit is prohibited because the DJA does not explicitly allow for this type of lawsuit. But that's not the right question. The question is not what the DJA says or what its language says. The question instead is what effect the notice statute has on the common law. So I'd like to briefly talk about what the common law said going back to 1996 when this
Perhaps you'll be informing me with the rest of your comments, but why are you so dismissive of the text of the DJA?
Well, I think the reason, I wouldn't say
You wouldn't say dismissive. You would say underplaying or minimizing. How's that?
That's a little bit better. Thank you, Your Honor. I would say that the DJA is just a very broad general statute, and the legislature can't possibly enumerate in the DJA every single type of cause of action that it allows. And it's really a catch-all, and that's where the DJA says that a party may seek declaratory relief even if no other type of relief is allowed. So that's meant to be a very broad, far-reaching statute. And the other reason why I'm, to use your word, Your Honor, a little dismissive of the language of the DJA is because we're not just relying on the DJA versus the notice statute. We're also relying on the common law. And as the Journal Sentinel at least seems to acknowledge, there was a common law right to seek declaratory relief before a public record was released. So it's really not what the DJA says. It's more of what the common law provided for. And the common law provided for a declaratory action. And going back to 1996, that's when this court decided the Wozniacki case, which created these rights to pre-release notice and judicial review. And that case involved public employees, and so did a case called Milwaukee Teachers 3 years later, which this court decided and which extended the Wozniacki case.
But are you really conceding that you're being dismissive of the text of the statute, or are you trying to harmonize two different statutes?
I'm just using Justice Amos Bradley's wording. I'm trying to harmonize the two statutes, and I think the key point is that this is maybe a good way of looking at it. Both of the statutes are silent on the issue, or maybe you could say ambiguous, because the DJA doesn't say whether or not this type of action is allowed, but similarly, the notice statute does not say whether declaratory actions are allowed or not. It doesn't mention the DJA. So the big question for the court is who wins when both statutes on this subject are silent? In whose favor does this silence cut? And my position is that this silence cuts in my client's favor because we have this pre-existing common law right. So that means it triggers these canons of strict construction. So the court has to strictly construe.
Mr. Osnall, can I just ask you to explain that, given that that's the way you're looking at the DJA in 19.356, how then, under your theory, help me explain then how to interpret 19.356 sub 2 sub A with the, where they have the three exceptions, because you're saying it's not clear. It seems pretty clear that there are three exceptions to that statute and only three exceptions. So I'm not sure how to reconcile what I'm reading here with what you're saying.
Sure, Your Honor. So you read my mind, because I was going to go there pretty soon eventually. So I think that there are two different things that we're talking about here. One is the right to pre-release notice, and the other is the right to judicial review. Those are two distinct concepts. They go hand in hand in a sense that if you don't have advance notice, you do, but you can still have a right to judicial review without a right to notice. And to get to your question specifically, I think subsection 2, paragraph A, deals with the right to advance notice. And I'll admit that that provision of the notice statute does abrogate the common law right to pre-release notice and replaces it with a statutory right. So in other words, this statute does narrow the common law right to pre-release notice, but it doesn't completely eliminate it. And I'll admit that those three subdivisions under 2A do provide for the three statutory exceptions under this statute anyway for pre-release notice. But that doesn't answer the question of the right to judicial review. And that question would turn on subsection 1 of the notice statute, which says that pre-release notice and judicial review are allowed as provided in this section, meaning the notice statute, and as otherwise provided by statute. So the big question is, what does otherwise provided by statute mean? Does it include or not?
And right. So if you're saying it includes the DJA, when you use the DJA, what the DJA does, it's like a pre-declaration of the law, right? And it's used that way in contract claims, in breach of contract claims, right? It's saying that if certain events occur, there will be a claim. So what I'm struggling with is, fine, you get to the DJA, you put it there, there still has to be some kind of claim or declaration that the court would be reaching. And so does that put you into 146? I mean, you're saying it's the common law that the court would somehow be declaring about, and you're not arguing Section 146?
Well, there are a couple of rights that the associations are asking to be declared. And the big issue, the big argument that the associations made in the circuit court is that releasing these records would violate 146.82. But they also did make a shorter argument that if the court disagrees, if the circuit court disagrees with that statutory analysis, that it should conduct the common law balancing test to decide whether the public interest in disclosing these records outweighs the privacy interests involved. So there are two different arguments as to why the records shouldn't be released. But the big one is 146.82, as Justice Dallet pointed out. So I think that that statute really, though, involves the first issue presented, which asks about standing. I don't know if 146.82 is relevant to the second question of whether the notice statute prohibits this type of lawsuit.
Counsel, so you talked about being clearly abrogated, but the text is pretty. If I were to think about how I could clearly abrogate something, I might say something almost exactly like this text says. You can't do it except as we say right here, or some other statute that says you can do it. You can't. No person is entitled to judicial review in that context. It seems to me that your argument, correct me if I'm wrong here, but that the Declaratory Judgment Act, would allow almost anybody to come in and do pre-release litigation, that would be the logical consequence of it. Because you could make an argument, if I have some sort of, right, or maybe it depends on some other statute. But I'm trying to think of what limiting principle there would be. It almost seems like your argument leads to the conclusion that any time a requester would get the law, or a custodian would get the law wrong, that they're subject to a pre-release suit. Am I misunderstanding the sort of logic of your position, or what limits do you see?
I do see a few limits, Your Honor, and I think one important limit is this statute, the notice statute, clearly and quite limitedly abrogates the common law right to advance notice, meaning there's now a very limited right to advance notice. And that's more of a pragmatic limitation than maybe a strictly legal one, in the sense that if the state hadn't provided WMC with a courtesy notice, this lawsuit wouldn't be here. So the government can easily avoid this type of declaratory lawsuit by just not providing a courtesy notice. And there are a couple of legal limiting principles as well. One is the doctrine of standing. A party needs a direct and personal stake in the outcome of the lawsuit. And the other limitation, I would say, is the exclusivity rule, which the parties dealt with a little bit in their briefs. So in my view, this is at least debatable, though, but in my view, if one of the exceptions in the notice statute is in play, meaning private sector employees or public employees or records that were obtained pursuant to a search warrant or subpoena, in one of those cases, if somebody wants to sue title advance notice, then they have to follow the procedures in the notice statute. I don't think that a public employee, for example, I don't think a public employee could sue under the DJA if their employer was going to release one of their disciplinary records. I think they would have to follow the strict confines of the statute. So I think those are the real limiting principles here, that I'm not asking to go back to the Wozniacki era. I'm conceding that the notice statute does abrogate the common law right to advance notice and provides just a few limited exceptions.
So the as otherwise provided by statute is if I'm hearing you correctly, and as I understood your briefing, is your argument that the Declaratory Judgment Act is as otherwise provided by statute, or is your argument that Chapter 146 is otherwise provided by statute, or both?
Both, Your Honor, but the only one on which my clients can rely is the DJA, because Chapter 146, Section 146.84, I think it's one, sub one, paragraph C, that does clearly provide for a cause of action to enjoin the release of a record. And the State and the Journal Sentinel both seem to concede in their briefs that that statute is one of the otherwise provided by statutes. But we can't rely on that one because that one only allows an individual to sue and these three associations and not an individual, but they are a person. So my position is that we are relying only on the DJA when we're saying what otherwise provided by statute means in the notice statute. That refers to 146.84, 1C, as well as the DJA. And I'll concede that if this pre-existing common law right never existed, then I might be in trouble because as otherwise provided by statute, just in the abstract, in a vacuum, may or may not include the DJA. But I think when the legislature enacted this statute, they really were trying to address this floodgates concern that was Nikki unleashed. And the legislature also presumably knew that there was this common law right to judicial review before a record is released. So if they wanted to completely eliminate the use of the DJA, they could have easily said so, but they didn't. So that suggests the legislature intended to leave this right to review intact.
Counsel,
while greatly limiting.
Oh, my biggest problem with your lawsuit is the Declaratory Judgment Act is used to declare a right, but it provides no rights. So you have to be looking somewhere else for the right that you want to use the Declaratory Judgment Act to declare, correct?
Right.
Okay. The only thing I hear you talking about is medical records, and I don't see where WMC has any right in medical records. I feel your pain for your members in not wanting to release the documents, but I don't see where WMC has a right to have a declaration made about medical records.
Sure. So we can talk more about standing, certainly, because that's really what I think that issue is.
No, it's not standing. You got to have a right before you have standing to raise it. I want to go to the bottom. I want to know what is the right you're relying on that you want to use the declaratory judgment action for. That's what I want to know.
My clients are asking for a couple of declarations from the circuit court. One is that releasing these records would violate 146.82.
But is that WMC's claim to make? I know that there's been an amendment of the pleadings, which aren't before us, and there are individuals whose records are at issue. But we're, in this lawsuit, just looking at WMC's right. Where is its right in those records?
Sure. So if I may, before I directly get to that question, I do want to just remind the court that there is also an argument that the association's members are entitled to have these records not released under the common law balancing test, but we don't have to spend much time talking about that if nobody wants to. But to get back to Your Honor's question directly, I think the court has to look at 146.82 and 146.84 together. And 146.84 has a couple of remedy provisions, sub 1, paragraph B and paragraph BM. And those provisions allow any person to sue for damages if a record is released and the release harms them, and they can sue any other person, including the government. And the State and the Journal Sentinel don't seem to dispute that my three clients' member businesses are persons under those remedy provisions. So the question, I like to frame it as whether we're in the zone of interests, whether my clients' members are within the zone of interests of those two confidentiality statutes. And I think that we are because the remedy provision envisions any person suing, not just the patient, but any person.
Does the zone of interest test have application outside of an administrative appeal under Chapter 227?
I think it does, Your Honor. I think it's been broadly used in other cases, too, and I think it's just one of these sort of generic tests for deciding whether there's standing. But I think that one important point is the court shouldn't necessarily require a plaintiff to fit within one of these sort of boxes of standing, like zone of interest or taxpayer standing. I think the big takeaway point from that McConkie case that the parties have discussed is standing is a prudential requirement in Wisconsin state court, not a jurisdictional requirement. And the point, the reason behind requiring parties to have standing is to ensure that they that their interests are sufficiently adverse such that they will adequately raise and brief the issues. So I think there's no question that the parties in this case are adverse and that they have adequately briefed the case. So I don't think the court should get too caught up in deciding whether it's zone of interest versus taxpayer standing or something else. I think that those are just convenient sort of labels, but I don't think that a party has to necessarily fit within one box or the other.
But that's our job, to define words and to focus on labels that happen to be in the statute. So, you know, the McConkie case, it is argued, is kind of a unique case dealing with a constitutional amendment. In some ways, it takes my breath away, but as I understand it, it's never been followed by any court since then for the wide-open premise of, well, you really don't need a legally protected interest, or you really don't need standing because this is such a unique case. Is there any other case that has relied on that rationale for standing? I just don't recall any.
That's the only one I'm aware of, and that's the only one that the parties have cited in their brief. But one subject that we haven't talked about yet is taxpayer standing, and I think that taxpayer standing is separate and distinct from zone of interest standing. So I think if a plaintiff satisfies taxpayer standing, then they don't need to show that they're within the zone of interest of some other statute. And the taxpayer standing doctrine has been very broadly and liberally applied going back 100 years or more in this state.
Counsel, I'm unaware of it. I had some more requests for it, but I'm unaware of any case where we have understood that, you know, an employee who sneezes, that constitutes taxpayer standing. You know, we've talked about an expenditure of funds here. And it seems that the consequence of your taxpayer standing argument is that any person who's a taxpayer could challenge any illegal act by any government, you know, by any government official. We admittedly have pretty broad authority to allowed certain broad challenges under the taxpayer standing doctrine. But it seems that you're asking us to expand it far beyond any case that I'm aware of, and the line's a little murky, right? I mean, you know, spent a trifling interest may suffice, and I understand that. But if the argument is that an employee spending any time doing something illegal means any taxpayer can sue, that means anybody can challenge anything. That seems like a very different kind of doctrine than it's ever recognized in our courts.
Sure. So I guess I'd like to give a two-part answer. So first, I think that taxpayer standing is maybe close to as broad as your question would suggest. And I think that any time the government is proposing to spend taxpayer money on illegal activity, taxpayers can sue to enjoin that from happening because they have a right to ensure that their tax dollars are not spent illegally. But my second point is that if the court is a little uncomfortable with viewing taxpayer standing that broadly, or at least in the context of this case, maybe really the real limiting principle here is the plaintiff needs a personal direct interest in the case or personal direct harm in addition to this generic sort of harm that taxpayers suffer when the government spends their money illegally. And if the court wants to adopt that sort of personal harm requirement that taxpayer standing doesn't currently require, then I think the associations and their members in this case certainly satisfy that personal harm requirement because the association's member businesses are at great risk of reputational and financial harm if these records are released.
So can you explain how these are somehow patient health care records? I read the definition of that statute as all records related to the health of a patient prepared by or under the supervision of a healthcare provider, and DHS is not a healthcare provider, and I understand these to be summaries that are made under another statute in Section 250, in Chapter 250. So can you explain how you're even in the realm of 146?
Sure. So I think that there are at least two arguments that my clients were making in the circuit court as to why these records are patient healthcare records. And the easier answer doesn't even involve that definition that you just cited, Your Honor. It involves 252.05. And the state has conceded in the circuit court that they obtained this information they're trying to release pursuant to that statute.
Right. And they have the health care records. Let's assume they have them. But what they have created is a summary document with no names and with numbers, from what I understand. So how, and that's what you're seeking to block being turned over, not the records themselves. So tell me about that summary. How does that meet the definition?
Well, I think 252.05 sub 6 says when the state obtains records, it must treat those records as patient health care records. And the independent argument is that these records, and we don't know because the facts are undeveloped because we're still at the pleading stage, but at least plausibly, if one could believe that health care providers created records saying these patients have COVID, and then those records eventually found their way into the government's hands, and that when DHS had those records, it was required to keep the information in those records confidential.
Okay, and where do you see anywhere in any of these statutes that talks about the, keeping the information confidential? Do you, is there any reference at all to that in any of the statutes?
Yes, Your Honor. 146.84 has some remedy and penalty provisions, and it says in a few, it uses the word information in a few places, and it says anyone who releases information in violation of 146.82 may be sent to jail and fined. So I think that that 146.84 clearly envisions that information is being protected. And frankly, I don't think the statute really would provide for much of a right to privacy if somebody could take a record that they're entitled to have but prohibited from releasing and then just send out a big email with all of the content from that record summarized in an email.
Okay, not, and looking at what you're saying under penalties, the full section is discloses confidential information with knowledge that the disclosure is unlawful and is not reasonably necessary. But you're saying the fact that it even says information is how you get there.
Right. I think
now we're protecting information.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the ways. I think 146.82 would be completely toothless if somebody could take a confidential record and then just release all the information from it without releasing the record. I see my red light is on, so I'll finish that thought during rebuttal if necessary. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Kowalski.
May it please the court. Clay Kowalski appearing on behalf of the state defendants, and I have two main points today. The first point is that this case should be viewed as a case about statutory interpretation. The plaintiffs lack a justiciable claim because the patient health care records law that they're invoking does not cover or protect them. Second point is that WSSTAT section 19.356 sub 1 bars their claim. The legislature set forth who can pursue a claim for pre-release judicial review of an authority's decision to release records, and the plaintiff's case does not fall within any of the listed categories, and is they have cited no exception to that rule.
I'd like to go back to your first point and start there. Why shouldn't this court remand the case back to the circuit court? The reason I'm asking is because the plaintiffs filed an amended complaint, a second amended complaint. They added in, or they were trying to add individuals whose information that they had tested positive for COVID-19 was part of the records that were released, arguably. But before the circuit court had an opportunity to grant the motion to allow that amendment, an interlocutory appeal was filed, and the Court of Appeals granted that. Did the Court of Appeals jump the gun, given the fact that the complaint, the plaintiffs were seeking to amend their complaint to add people who would have a, arguably have a claim to advance under Chapter 146?
So the Court of Appeals, there's a footnote in the decision that does say it is remanding the case, and it specifically says, in light of what we've said in our decision, the circuit court could consider whether to allow that amendment. So we're asking for the Court of Appeals to be affirmed. We think that that amendment would, in fact, be futile in terms of whether individual people could seek the statewide remedy that the current plaintiffs got. We don't think that individual patients could seek a statewide injunction. They might be able to go back and, if the amendment is granted, pursue a claim as to their records.
That's fair, but the point I'm getting at is that we've had a lot of judicial resources expended on this case based on a complaint that the plaintiffs were seeking to amend, and such amendments are typically freely allowed. So we had a court of appeals issue a published decision, which arguably has some problematic language in it that I'll get into later. Now this court is hearing a case, and it strikes me that it's not the best use of appellate resources given the fact of the amendment. So the issue I'm looking at is whether this court can give guidance to the Court of Appeals with respect to interlocutory appeals under these circumstances.
This court can definitely give guidance on that. We think, again, that we would not be in favor of the amendment. We think that it would be futile, again, to search the statewide relief or to seek that statewide relief that was granted. And I think the court is going to set forth principles about how to interpret Chapter 146 that may inform whether it's even appropriate for those individuals to be a part of the case. Specifically, you know, the court is going to be interpreting a key provision, 146.841C, which says an individual would be the person or thing out there that could pursue an injunction. So I think the court has to interpret that provision, and in doing so, it's going to provide guidance that will be useful on remand. We think that, again, we're asking for affirmance of the Court of Appeals. There is a footnote in the decision that says that the Court of Appeals was anticipating a remand to consider whether that motion should be granted. I believe we will oppose the motion. I can't stand here today and say what our position is going to be exactly. But we think that, yes, there's been a lot of resources expended on this case. We're just at the pleading stage. DHS's release of these records has been held up for going on years now. That should never happen, and this court needs to keep its focus on the fact this is a public records case. This is a public records case. We're dealing with Chapter 19, 356, which says that, and I'll quote it, no person is entitled to judicial review of the decision of an authority to provide a requester with access to a record. That's the starting point. As Justice Hagedorn pointed out, that's where we start. Could it be any clearer when you're trying to abrogate the common law right? I don't think it could be any clearer. I think that is the easier way to resolve the case. We think the case also presents important justiciability questions. I want to make a point that was made in the briefs. I want to make sure it's not lost, which is that when this court decided the Moustakas case in 2016, it pointed out in footnote 2 there that there's a difference between standing and statutory interpretation. This is a statutory interpretation case. It's looking at whether there's a claim at all. And our position is that there is no claim here for these associations under Chapter 140. They have no claim. So the court doesn't need to get into taxpayer standing, messy standing doctrines. Just look at the statutes and apply them. That's all it needs to do.
Are you able to tell me how it is that DHS got a hold of private medical information about individuals? I know there's a debate about the facts and what was disclosed and whether we can have medical information coming from a medical record be repackaged into a different record and then it could be disclosed. But setting all of that aside, how is it that DHS got in its hands of the private medical information of individuals? And does that really comport with the declaration of policy under 19.31, which is to give the citizens of this state access to the workings of government? But there's another interest at stake here, and I guess that gets into the balancing test that I didn't get a chance to ask your friend on the other side about.
Right. So that, there's a lot to unpack in that question, but I think that, number one, DHS came into this information because it has a duty to surveil communicative disease incidences in the state. So it could have found out about the information through local DHSs reporting the information to the state DHS. That's a requirement if a local DHS becomes aware of a COVID case. We put in our brief a link to a form that can be used for a local entity to report those incidences to DHS, who then compiles them. Many of us are probably familiar with the dashboard on DHS's website. It's been like a ubiquitous thing during COVID. I know I personally look at it like daily, semi-daily to see, well, how many cases were there? And I'm sure many of us have. DHS gathers that information statewide through reporting that is required under chapters 250 and 252. So that's how it came into that information.
Just to be clear, what exactly is being requested?
So we need to focus on the actual allegations in the complaint. So what is actually being requested and what was going to be disclosed?
What was the information or record request?
So the request was for which businesses had COVID cases. So that is, there's an actually example that we cited in the record of a request. There's one example.
And DHS is the record keeper of which businesses have people who have COVID cases.
They would know that information if, when the report occurred, it listed the business's name in addition to the person's name and other information. So I want to be clear that...
So if a person goes in to be tested for COVID, what happens with that information? They go to their doctor, they're tested for COVID. How does that work?
Well, it could be reported. Say they have a healthcare organization that provides their insurer. Their insurer might keep that information.
Probably through their employer, maybe.
Probably through their employer. In my case, I'll use myself as an example. I have my insurance through my employer. If I go and get tested for COVID, they're going to know it's my employer.
If it were your neighbor couldn't go get your health care information, right?
Correct.
Okay. So now the person goes in, is tested, and what happens with that information? The person releases it to the government to know this information?
No, I believe the provider, if there's a positive COVID test, would be required under 250 and 252 to make a report. That information then would get to DHS.
So the person never releases it. They just go in to get the health care that they think they need, and unbeknownst to them, it's forwarded to the government.
That's the law. That's what the system of legislature has set up.
And so now the record request is to get something that otherwise would be private to that person. Through going through the government?
No, it's not. Okay. So the record request here was made to find out how many businesses had either positive COVID tests at their business or contacts. So, and it was limited to only businesses with 25 or more employees. And DHS placed that limitation on its responses, or I should say its proposed responses, because DHS recognized, well, if you have two employees and they're both test positive, then we'd be releasing who had COVID at that business. So I want to be clear.
I hate to interrupt you. I think you said 25 or less employees.
I meant 25 or more.
Okay, that's what I thought.
So in this case, the First Amendment complaint alleges that the information that would be released is if a business of 25 or more had either COVID case at that business or any contact. So that was done through contact tracing, because that's another piece of data that could be in DHS's system. So we're not going to, DHS is not, pursuant to these public records requests, releasing any patient's information. The two pieces of information that are going to be released are the name of the business, how many cases or contacts, a number. So it could be business name, 2. That's the information that will be released.
Well, let's say you have a business that has 25 employees, and so that business name gets disclosed, and there were 2 employees who were out sick. No one knew why, or maybe they didn't even know they were out sick. All the other employees, the other 23 who were going to work, would then know that those 2 employees had COVID. So it's really not keeping their information, their private medical information, private, right?
We think it is, because we don't think that's reasonable that, based on the 2 pieces of information I just mentioned, business name, number 2, that you can tell who has COVID at that business. We don't think that from the way this is alleged in the complaint, you can't tell who that would be.
Does the DHS website advise the people of Wisconsin that if they tell their doctor, or if they go to their doctor because they're sick and they find out they have COVID-19, are people advised that their doctors are disclosing their confidential medical information to the state?
Well, to the extent that it cites chapters 250 and 252, I think that those laws would inform everyone of that because of the surveillance duties of DHS.
Mr. Kosky, would there have been any dates associated with the reporting? That is, would it say business, in the example you just gave, the name of the business, number of people, and then the date at all, when they had tested positive?
Now we're getting into kind of construing what the First Amendment complaint says, because obviously the First Amendment complaint was filed at a certain time and the requests were made at a certain time. So presumably the requests were made, and then any information that existed prior to those requests would be what's implicated. And so I think we'd have to, again, the complaint itself doesn't describe the requests. Each of them is slightly different. We cited in our brief one example of a request from the Journal Sentinel, in fact, that's actually in the record. Right, it would have to be information that was in existence at the time of the request, and so it would be anything that from that time of the request looking back would be what's implicated.
And you said that it's not specific as to even people who tested positive for COVID, but that number also represents people they may have had contact with?
Right. That's why this case becomes almost a bit absurd, because we're talking about if employees of a business had contact. Say employees of a business went to a function at a bar, and they had contacts with people there that had COVID, but the employees themselves never got COVID.
So you could really never tell who had COVID, because that number, too, could just be people they had contact with.
Right. It includes people they just had contact with. So, and keep in mind, too, we're looking at this through 2020 vision as hindsight, because now we're in 2022. When this case got started, it was October of 2020. Things have changed quite a bit in terms of the number of people that have had contact with COVID since that time.
Is it in the record how many people in the state of Wisconsin have either had COVID or had contact with somebody with COVID?
No.
I'm imagining it's quite a high number of people. So it's the state's position that each one of those individuals, and I know you're disputing whether they'd actually have a claim under Chapter 146, but assuming that they do, each individual would have to file a lawsuit against DHS to protect against the release of their private medical information.
Yes.
Just to make sure I'm understanding your position on 19356. So you would say, if I'm an employee and I work for one of these companies where and I got wind of what was happening, could I file a pre-release case here?
It would be under Section 146.841C,
right.
Not under 19.356, in fact.
Right.
And I mean, technically, I guess it is, because it would be an otherwise provided for statute.
Okay. So you agree that statute is otherwise provided, but it's limited to individuals?
Correct.
Yeah.
Why did DHS give notification to WMC and not to the individuals whose records or record information was going to be disclosed?
That I don't know. It's not in the record.
Okay.
It was a courtesy notice to WMC.
But why? Why, if WMC has no standing, as the state is arguing, to object to the release of the information, why give it to WMC and not to the individuals?
That I don't know.
Okay.
Is this an example of no good deed goes unpunished?
I had not thought about it that way, but
I mean, a courtesy notice. I mean, I don't know.
Obviously, it was not necessary.
Let me just get this straight. So, Jane Smith, in order to protect the fact that Jane Smith either had COVID or had contact with another person who had COVID, Jane Smith would have to bring a lawsuit as Jane Smith against DHS.
Correct.
That kind of defeats the purpose of confidentiality, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, that's what the legislature has provided for in Chapter 146. So
in other words, in order to protect your confidentiality, you need to personally file a lawsuit.
You could try and do so anonymously as a Jane Doe.
But how would you file a lawsuit when you don't even know your information is being disclosed?
You might not be able to if you don't know your information is being disclosed. But again, that's the system the legislature has created, and the legislature would have to change that system.
Would there be any stopping point to what the government could access if it chose to?
Well, in this case, we have to keep in mind it's very limited. Again, as I said, we're only talking about the names of businesses,
right,
and the number.
Right, but we're not just deciding this case. It's at the Supreme Court, so we're deciding what the statute means. What limits are on the government being able to obtain personal healthcare information, and then the paper or whoever wants to get the information? What are the limits?
The statute. So the statute says that you can't disclose patient health care records. That's what we're talking about here. These are not patient health care records.
That's just, well, I mean, they are indirectly, aren't they? I mean, without knowing that person had COVID or was around someone who had COVID, that can't become usable information to DHS.
Our position is that the records that were proposed to be disclosed are not patient health care records.
Counsel, you've offered a few different, you know, ways in your view that your client would be successful in this suit. What do you think your top two strongest arguments are?
Number one, well, first, both are statutes. 19.356 sub 1 bars the plaintiff's claim. Straightforward statutory interpretation. Doesn't need to get messy at all. Another straightforward approach here is that is recognizing that the only relief that the plaintiffs have requested is an injunction. Straightforward interpretation of 146.84 sub 1c says only an individual can get an injunction to stop the violation of the patient health care records law. Again, straightforward, not messy. It gets messier if the court touches more doctrines, if it starts getting into standing. It gets terribly messy in taxpayer standing. So I want to comment on taxpayer standing and bring a quote to the fore here from the City of Appleton case, 142 Wis Second 877. The taxpayer must allege and prove a direct and personal pecuniary loss, a damage to himself different in character from the damage sustained by the general public. So this court has never disavowed that doctrine. And this case is unique in that we have a specific statute that provides a cause of action. Unlike FABIC, we were talking about taxpayer standing only in that case. And I believe the proper analysis is when anytime someone invokes a statute, they have to show that they're within the zone of interest of that statute, at least arguably. So you can't skip zone of interest if you invoke a statute. You can't skip to taxpayer standing. It doesn't work that way. This court has never held that. And I bring that quote up from the City of Appleton case because this court would need to grapple with that same principle, direct and personal pecuniary loss different from that of the public. It would have to grapple directly with that if it wanted to go down the taxpayer standing path. And it shouldn't do so for the reasons Justice Hagedorn pointed out. Any person could challenge any government action as a taxpayer, just solely based on the fact they're a Wisconsin taxpayer, if the court went down that path. That is the wrong path. It is inconsistent with precedent. There's no case that holds that. And so that is the wrong path in this case. Again, I think the two easiest, and I see my lights on, so I'll just ask that this court would affirm the Court of Appeal.
Thank you. Mr. Kamenet?
May it please this honorable court, I am Tom Kamenek, president of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, and I represent the intervener, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In 2003, the legislature eliminated the common law right to challenge the release of public records, replacing it instead with a limited statutory process. This case shows exactly why the legislature did that. My client requested these records almost 2 years ago now. The government custodian agrees that the records should be released. And yet the plaintiffs have been able, without ever proving yet that the release of these records would be unlawful, to delay that release for over a year and a half. They've already achieved a major victory by doing so. Because, Your Honors, this is a case about who decides. Prior to 2003, it was the court's job to decide who can bring a lawsuit challenging the release of records. In enacting 19.356, the legislature said, as it has done for many claims against the government, we will decide how and by whom such cases may be brought. And I think this case boils down entirely to whether or not the Declaratory Judgment Act otherwise provides a method of challenging the release of records. And I think a simple exercise in logic describes why that is not the case. For the Declaratory Judgment Act to do so, it must do so in its language. And if it does so now, if the language does so now, then the language also did so prior to 1996. But we know that is not true because everybody here agrees Wozniacki created a new right. And Wozniacki could not have done that if that right was already existing somewhere in the language of the Declaratory Judgment Act. There is no free-floating right to challenge the release of records.
Counsel, I want to just explore the limits of your argument here and make sure I understand it. Suppose that I'm a citizen who's a subject of a records request, and I understand that a records custodian is going to, say, release my Social Security number and my bank account information, okay, and not scrub it out, all right? And suppose that everybody would agree that maybe under the balancing test they shouldn't do that, right, which is part of the public records law. So I'm trying to at least construct a scenario where let's assume a records custodian is going to act illegally, and I know they're going to act illegally. Is the consequence of your argument that if it's not an employee, right, you know, or doesn't fit under the other sort of specifically enumerated things, I'm not aware of any other statute that directly addresses those, so let's assume it doesn't. Is the consequence of your argument that that I would not have any pre-release claim, that I just have to wait for it to be released and then I can sue?
I think that's right, Your Honor. It may not be the best solution. It may not be the best way to set up this system, but that is the way the legislature has chosen. And I think it's not a question of efficiency, but rather of one of what the legislature has provided. There are plenty of places in the law where the legislature has created immunity for itself, for other portions of state and local governments. And the legislature certainly could have removed entirely the ability to challenge the pre-release of records. It did not do that. It said it may be allowed, but it said it will only be allowed where we say it can be allowed. It was worried. The special committee that was created to look at this problem noticed, hey, record subjects might not be just employees. It could be anybody who's the subject of the record. And if the plaintiffs are right about what the legislature did with 356, it seems what they're saying is the only thing it did was make it harder for employees to challenge the release of records, and the legislature is allowing anybody else to do that. But I don't know why they would have made it harder for the employees than the rest of the general public to challenge the release of their records. The plaintiffs really want to bring a 19356 action, but without abiding by all those restrictions. It is really tough to bring a 356 action. There are strict deadlines. There are short deadlines. They apply to only certain people. But the plaintiffs here want to be placed in a better position than those employees. They want to be in a better position than record subjects, because record subjects have no right under the Declaratory Judgment Act to bring any kind of action challenging a decision to release, or to not release, rather, or a decision to delay the release of records. They can't use that. They have to use the provisions set forth in the Open Records Law.
Do you think it's of any importance that the Court of Appeals jumped in to take this interlocutory appeal of an order denying a motion to dismiss, that it was taken while there was a pending motion to amend the complaint? And why isn't that an abuse of discretion? Typically, you like a case to play out a little bit before you jump in and take interlocutory appeal, whether things pending before the circuit court that could directly impact whether or not the case should proceed further.
Like the state, I agree that the individuals who are seeking to join this case could not enjoin the release of all of these records. They would only be able to challenge the release of records about themselves. And this whole case is trying to be a statewide injunction on the release of all these records from the DHS. It is within the record, we know there are over 20 record requests for this information. And this bigger question of can anybody use the Declaratory Judgment Act to get around the prohibition in 19356 sub 1 is a really important question for this law-developing court to answer. And I'm the one who asked the Court of Appeals to take it, so I'm glad they did, and I'm glad the question can be resolved here by this court. The plaintiffs have said that the Declaratory Judgment Act, or rather our argument leads to a conclusion that the Declaratory Judgment Act was partially repealed by 356. And I think that's the wrong way of looking at that, because the Declaratory Judgment Act is a remedy statute, and it's a filter. It's an empty vessel placed on existing claims, as has been said before. To use an analogy, if the legislature changes a Class H felony to a Class G felony, you would not say that that partially repealed the statute that sets forth what a Class H felony sentencing guidelines are.
Counsel, except as otherwise provided by statute, what are some of the otherwise provided by statute things? What are the other places where the legislature has specified an exception to the no judicial review?
If there's the three that were talked about in the briefs that are all medical records or very similar records, 146.84, 51.30, and the other one that escapes my mind. And one of the amicus parties raised another one, which was actually created at the same time as 356, which was 196.135, which says that businesses whose records are in front of the Public Service Commission can actually use a very detailed process that looks a little bit like the 356 process in order to challenge a decision to release those records. And so we know what it looks like when the legislature does this otherwise providing. We can use those as examples.
And you do agree that 146.84.1c could be an otherwise or is an otherwise provided, just not applicable to
yes.
your opponents in this case?
It says that they can, an individual can bring an injunction to halt the violation of that statute, and what that statute is, of course, is releasing medical records. In Moustakas 1, I think one of the important things this court said was that the prohibition in 356.1 must be read in a way that, quote, favors an interpretation that fulfills the statute's purpose. And the statute's purpose, when the legislature created 356, was to strictly limit who could bring these kinds of claims. If you allow a declaratory judgment action, that blows the ocean wide open for who can bring these claims. Because as long as you can say release would be illegal for this reason, and I believe I would be harmed for that reason, anybody who can meet those two things could use the declaratory judgment action. And I think you've completely undone what the legislature did at that point.
Mr. Kamenik, Justice Hagedorn asked Ms. Kowski about the best arguments, and in response, Attorney Kowski gave two. He said the best arguments for your side are that 19.356 bars this claim, and second, you were just talking about 146.84, that it says only an individual can get an injunction under the whole 146 statutory scheme. Do you agree that those are the best two arguments for your side of this lawsuit?
Yes, I would like to see this court rule specifically that the Declaratory Judgment Act does not otherwise provide a method of judicial review of the decision of a custodian or an authority to release records as set forth in the prohibition of 356.1. I think that's an important decision to be made by this court. I think it's, as Attorney Kosky said, that is the statutory interpretation way of looking at it rather than standing. This court preferred that approach in both Voters with Facts and Woznicki. Sorry, not Woznicki, Moustakas. My red light is on, so thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Rose now.
Under the state's logic, individual plaintiffs should bring over 1,000 lawsuits challenging the release of their confidential patient health care records. So if the court is concerned about opening the floodgates, then it should reverse the court of appeals and allow this single lawsuit to go forward instead of thousands of lawsuits. The state, during its argument today, argued that the records here are not patient health care records, but at the same time, the state conceded that it obtained the information in these records pursuant to a surveillance authority under Chapters 250 and 252. So by the state's own admission, these records are patient health care records under 25205 sub 6, regardless of the actual technical definition of patient health care records. Sub 6 of 25205 says the state must treat records as patient health care records under 146.82, actually a range of statutes that includes that one, when it obtains records under 252 under surveillance powers.
Counsel, if we don't agree that one, well, you agree that you're not you're not representing an individual under 146.84.1c. So what are the other otherwise provided that you're thinking you fall under? Again, can you just tick those off for me to make sure I have those? Is it just the Declaratory Judgment Act? More broadly, is it anything else in 146?
The only otherwise provided by statute on which my clients and their member businesses can rely is the Declaratory Judgment Act. But the second amended complaint, which has not been denied or granted yet, is trying to add two plaintiffs, individual plaintiffs, John Doe and Jane Doe. So they are addressing the Chief Justice's concern over identifying themselves. And Jane Doe and John Doe are two individual employees, and their employer fits the government's criteria of business names that it's going to release. So if this court affirms the Court of Appeals decision, then the Circuit Court ideally will just allow the second amended complaint to be filed, in which case this lawsuit could then go forward under 146.84, sub 1, paragraph C. I would like to talk very briefly about taxpayer standing to sort of correct something.
Before you do that, can I interrupt and ask you to address what you had mentioned earlier, which is the balancing test and its application in this case, should DHS have agreed to disclose these records in the first place?
Sure. So the associations did argue in the alternative that if 146 does not apply to them or does not apply to these records, then under the balancing common law balancing test, these records should not be released. There does seem to be a little issue lurking in the background about whether if the DJA allows this type of lawsuit to go forward, is that only if it's a statutory claim or can a common law balancing test claim also be brought under the DJA? And that's something that the parties didn't really get into. My position would be that a party could bring a common law balancing test claim as well, but if the court is looking for some sort of limiting principle, then perhaps it could say the DJA is an avenue for this type of lawsuit only if it's a statutory claim, not for a common law balancing test claim.
Help me with what you just said. I understood it to be that regardless of what this court, how it interprets the relevant statutes, that a common law claim survives. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the common law right to file a lawsuit pre-record release survives.
And so if that is the argument, doesn't that almost render moot our exercise in interpreting the statutes?
No, Your Honor, I don't. Do you mean besides the notice statute, all the 146 statutes as well?
The notice, the pre-release judicial review, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I think all those decisions, like Moustakis interpreting the notice statute, I think they're still significant because the notice bill did change the common law quite a bit because it greatly restricted the right to pre-release notice. And again, if there's no right to pre-release notice, okay, then there's, practically speaking...
How about judicial review?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Judicial review, then.
Exactly. There's no opportunity for judicial review with mm-hmm. Courtesy notice. So perhaps this is a case of no good deed going unpunished, if Your Honor wants to put it that way. If I may talk about taxpayer standing very briefly, two quick points. One is that Hart versus Ament, which I cited in my reply brief, seems broader than this case because that case found taxpayer standing. That was a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, even though the taxpayer expenditures were going to be decreased by about $1 million per year. I see my red lights on if I could finish my...
Yes, you may.
The state said that under the City of Appleton case, taxpayer standing requires a personal harm distinct from the general public, and that's true. All that means is there needs to be personal harm that non-taxpayers aren't also suffering because the state omitted part of City of Appleton, which says an illegal expenditure of taxpayer funds causes all taxpayers a direct pecuniary harm. So I ask the court reverse the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Briefs and arguments, and we will take them under consideration. Court will adjourn and allow the next case to appear.